Hello, everybody. This is John Marks, and welcome to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. Today, we're going to talk about a very serious subject, and that is the subject of police suicide. But we're going to present it from a very interesting perspective. My guest today is Police Officer Kathleen Graves from the Seattle Police Department. Kathleen is in a very unique position as having attempted suicide and survived. And what's more important, she still has her career, and she is willing to talk to other cops about what she's been through. More and more police officers are committing suicide every year, and this is a subject we all need to talk about. It is uncomfortable. If Kathleen can talk about it, all of us should be talking about it. So, Kathleen, I want to welcome you, and I want to thank you very much for being willing to talk to us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure, truly. And, again, I want to salute you. You have been through some very tough circumstances, and yet you're willing to help other cops by sharing what you've learned and talking about it. So I'm going to try to be quiet here, and I just want to ask you to maybe introduce yourself as you want to be known, and please tell us your story, and we can talk about it when you finish.
Okay, well, my name is Kathleen. I've been on the Seattle Police Department for approximately 14 years. Primarily, most of my experience has been in patrol. I've done a lot of other specialty units and worked different precincts, but it's mostly been patrol. In the beginning, had a good career. I was in the academy in 1997, and it was at that same time that I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, which my mother had, and I had seen how it had ravaged her body over the years. And I was very concerned that I might not be able, you know, to sustain my career, but I was determined and knew that I'd just have to deal with it when the time came. And I had several, five, six really good years of working on the street and being a very productive, proactive officer. And as time went on and my body started to hurt more, of course, I had to slow down a little. And I tried to get myself into, different units that are a little less physically stressful. And it never seemed to work out. I felt that I couldn't really tell the department that I had a physical ailment, because if you're not fit for, for full duty, you're not fit for any duty. So I tried to keep it to myself and worked really hard. And at the same time, I was working with doctors to control the pain. And I've always been a heavy drinker, I shouldn't say. I never thought of myself as an alcoholic, but I was a binge drinker. And, of course, when you're on the police department, opportunities for going out with the group and hanging out after shift or whatever is a prime opportunity for something like that. And
yep.
When I started taking the pain medication that the doctors were prescribing me, it never really sunk in that it was an issue with mixing alcohol and pills and so on. But I had a, steadfast rule that I would never take anything on duty. So mostly I was in so much pain, especially throughout the day of what I was putting my body through, that at night, in order to sleep, I had to take pain meds and so on. And this went on for a few years. And the harder it became, the more hard I was on myself about not being the same officer I used to be and wanting to do so much more, worrying about my reputation, worrying about being a female in the department and not holding my end of things up, or having to work harder maybe than the average person in order to prove myself. And so, being the type A personality, which most cops are, trying to be the perfectionist and so on, I got to the point where I had to pretty much medicate myself every day. This went on for, a couple of years, and with it became emotional problems. I've always suffered from severe depression. This continued throughout my career. The stress of the career, the stuff that, the average police officer is subjected to, you know, we're really good at kind of compartmentalizing that and not dealing with it or letting, you know, things just roll off your back. And I thought I was really good at that because I could go to any scene and see any carnage and do anything that was asked of me and it never even be an issue. I mean, I never like lost sleep at night because of it. And what I've come to realize is that I've been compartmentalizing that and not dealing with it, just basically stuffing my issues. And so with the with seeing my career starting to fall out from underneath me, knowing that I couldn't take this up much longer at the rate I was going, trying desperately to get the department to assist me in some way without flat out saying I can't do my job. There's too much politics, too much red tape. I wasn't getting really any assistance. I tried employee assistance program. I tried talking to our shrink from the department. I tried going to our CIT officers. I tried talking to people of rank that could maybe help me out. Just nothing seemed to be happening. And my opiate usage increased. I basically could not get out of bed and to roll call and in uniform as much pain as I was in. And I started having to use painkillers in order to get to work. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I had to use painkillers to finish my shift. And then I'd have to use painkillers to go to sleep at night. And so it was, as your body starts to build up a tolerance, you know, the amount increases and increases. And you put alcohol on top of that, not a good thing. You put depression on top of that, the worst. Yep. And then you put losing, it's not just a career for me, it's my identity. It's what I have always wanted to be my entire life. It's all I've ever dreamed of. I have family in law enforcement, and it was just sort of my path. That was the end all for me. And to think that I was failing at that, or that I would lose that, lose my career, lose my identity, lose my purpose in life, it was almost unbearable. Mm-hmm. Towards the end, I was, you know, in a full-blown addiction. I had no clue that I was. It was nobody ever, you know, came to me and said, hey, we're worried about you. Hey, you're, you know, what's gone on? You're changing or anything like that. I got to the point where, as most addicts do, I was isolating big time. So I kept everybody in my life, you know, at arm's length. And they just didn't see really what was going on with me personally. There were a few, you know, specific incidents towards the end of my demise that sort of pushed me over the edge. And to me, you know, quitting my job, not only financially was hard to accept, but again, being a failure, being not being perfect, which is what I've always strived to do. I just couldn't see. There was just no way out. I would have lost my house. I had already lost all my friends. I felt like I had lost the respect from my coworkers. I knew I was spiraling downhill, and I didn't like myself. In fact, I hated myself. So it came to a point where they had, obviously I wasn't doing as well at work as I should be. I was very bitter, very angry, difficult to work with. They decided to transfer me from my squad, which is, you know, it's sort of like family, but I was having difficulties with some of the people in the squad, and they decided to transfer me to this other squad that was like the worst, and at least in my mind, was the bottom of the barrel. And I remember thinking that as the ultimate failure. I couldn't go any lower than I was at that moment. And I went home, and I had been hoarding medication for like the 10 years that I'd been dealing with the fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. Even though I didn't maybe use my whole bottle that month, I made sure that I always refilled it.
Right.
So that I had a huge hoard, and obviously this is addict behavior that I wasn't even aware of, worrying that I wouldn't have enough at some point or somebody would stop prescribing them to me and then I'd be screwed. So I hoarded, and I had not only were they prescribing me painkillers, several different types, Percocet, Vicodin, codeine, but they also prescribed me and anxiety, muscle relaxers, several types of sleeping pills. And mind you, this is all from one doctor. And I look back now and I'm like, what was this doctor thinking to prescribe so much to one person, and especially knowing what I did for a living? But anyway, that's another story. So I had always, I'd always been very depressed, and I had obviously thought of suicide on many occasions. I had got to the point about that time in my life where I had actually been planning it. I mean, I had a plan set in my mind of how I would do it and why I would do it and where I would do it and so on. So I came home that weekend and decided, I just made a decision, almost just like it was matter of fact, no emotion involved. I just made a decision that it was time. And I cleaned my house. I updated my will. I put stuff aside. I transferred all my money into my brother's account. I have a dog that's like my life. He's just like the closest thing to me in my life. And I had sort of tricked my best friend into taking him for the weekend. I told her, she has a big property out on an island, and I said, you know, oh, he just needs to get out and have some fun, and I was wondering if you could take him for the weekend. And so she comes to pick him up, and he's got a huge suitcase packed of everything that he owns, and it didn't dawn on her, you know, which being a cop, you're really, really good at manipulating people. And I've worked a lot of undercover, and I know how to, you know, I know how to lie. And I just made everybody, you know, feel like everything was fine, you know, just another day, blah, blah, blah. And she drove away with my dog, and I think that was the most pain throughout the whole ordeal, was watching him drive away. It was the hardest part for me, but I knew that she'd take good care of him. I had a party, a little like barbecue with all my neighbors. They came over, and unbeknownst to them, it was my goodbye to everybody. I got all my affairs in order, and on the morning that I was supposed to show up at roll call in my new squad, I took my two, I'm estimating maybe 200-300 pills. Mm-hmm. They were mixed, all different prescriptions, mostly painkillers. And I'd split them in half, and I had two kits. I call them my kits. The second one was in case I had thrown up the first one, and, you know, then I would be screwed. So I had a second one on hand just in case. And I left my car at home, because my brother lives nearby, and I knew that he would probably be, you know, checking on me. And I walked. I live right close to the county line, so I live in the city in which I work. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I wanted to do was have my squad. In fact, I even worked the district in which I lived, so it would have been my squad that found me. And I didn't want to get the Seattle police involved. I didn't want to get any of my squad. I didn't want to have to be seen like that. So I walked into another jurisdiction, and then I took a cab to a hotel by the airport. I checked in under an assumed name and paid cash, and I paid for 24 hours, which I expected to be plenty of time. Mm-hmm. I went up to the room. I wrote my brother's phone number and my sergeant's phone number on the pad next to the bed. I put my ID with that without even hesitating, without even thinking about it. I took the entire first pack of pills, and I don't even think it was minutes before I had no more memory. That's the last thing I remember. The rest of it was of the story was told to me by the people involved, and that was that 36 hours later, I was found in the hotel room, and I was still alive. What had happened is the hotel, I had run out my 24 hours, and they came looking for, you know, another night if I was going to stay. And, of course, I don't remember any of this, and I think I might have talked to somebody, and how the people didn't recognize that there was really something wrong here, I don't know. But I was able to give them my debit card to put, you know, to pay for another night because I didn't have enough cash. And when I had realized that I was still alive, I took the second pack of pills. And what had happened is my brother has access to my bank account. Uh-huh. He's always had my password and stuff. So he had noticed that the amount available and the amount balance had changed. And he was able to get the bank to tell him where that charge went through.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, there was a search party out for me. Apparently, they were using my home as the command post. And there were four different police jurisdictions involved. And they had been out hunting for me. And they had detectives, you know, in the airports, you know, looking for, see if I, you know, had run away or whatever. It was just, apparently it was just crazy. So he told them, you know, there was this charge just came through at this hotel in SeaTac. So everybody flocked to there, and they ended up turning the cafeteria in the lobby of the hotel into a command post.
Mm-hmm.
And getting the negotiators and the SWAT team out, and I mean, I don't know what it is that they were expecting. I mean, I was armed, but obviously, at least I thought, obviously, I wasn't out to hurt anyone else. It,
right.
You know, the only person I wanted to hurt was myself. And so they came up to the room. There was a hostage negotiator that was trying to get me to open the door, which I eventually did. And I had a couple little flashes of memory throughout this, and one of them was, and this is embarrassing for me to even admit, but before I had taken that first pack of pills, I had pinned my badge to the shirt I was wearing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I always had thought, or thought if I was going to die, it was going to be with my badge on.
Yeah.
And when they found me, I remember somebody was holding me up by my arms, like trying to keep me from, you know, falling.
Uh-huh.
And somebody else was poking me in the chest, poking the badge on my chest, saying, "Oh, what's this?" You know, like kind of making fun of me, like, "What are you wearing this for?" And being like just mortified on top of, you know, knowing that my whole department and all the people I work with were standing in there seeing me like this.
Yeah.
And then I remember a certain lieutenant reading me the official, whatever it is they're supposed to read me when they take my badge and gun away.
A Garrity warning, probably.
Yeah. So here I am in a hotel room. I've been unconscious for 36 hours. And I have them taking my gun and badge away right then and there. Why that was one of the very few memories that I have, I don't know, but it was one of the most devastating parts of all this. I was rushed in an ambulance to the hospital, and they ran tests. The doctor said that they could not believe that I had survived with the amount of stuff that I had in my system, sure. And the amount of time that I laid there. They said it was just almost completely impossible that I should have survived that. One of the many backlashes of that is when I was unconscious, I was laying on my right side the entire time, mm-hmm. and I had ended up doing nerve damage. So along my entire right side, my shoulder, my hip, my knee, and my ankle mm-hmm. are now permanently damaged. And on top of the fibromyalgia, you know, it's a considerable amount of pain. Anyway, so they had taken me to the hospital. They then put me in a mental hospital for 8 days. And on sort of like a condition to get out of the mental hospital, they told me I had to go to rehab. And I couldn't understand why rehab, because I didn't really think I had a problem. I didn't. I had a legitimate disorder, and I took the pills that were prescribed to me by my doctor.
Yeah.
And that's not an addict. That's just a person doing what the doctor told them to do. And I basically said, no, I'm not. I want to go home. And so they were able to convince me that if I wanted my job back, if I was interested in fighting to get my career back, that I would have to go to rehab. Well, at that point, I was like, career? Like, they would actually take me back? Are you kidding? I just tried to kill myself. They're not going to take me back. But I was alive.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, I'm not very religious, but there was a reason, I guess. I kept thinking to myself, there must be some reason that I survived. And if that was the case, then I was going to have to make a go of this. And when you're in that deep of a depression, and when your mind is that clouded with medication and depression and so on, you don't, the pain and that you're causing the people that you love, you just don't. I genuinely thought that I was helping my loved ones by killing myself. Mm-hmm. I knew that I was a burden to them. I knew that I could help them, at least help my brother by giving him, you know, my money. And I felt like it was the right thing to do for the mm-hmm. other people. And then, of course, waking up after all this has happened and getting counseling, I'm realizing how badly I hurt people. And yeah. how devastated my family was, and that was unbearable. Like, I felt like I could easily take my life, but when I saw what I had done to other people, I told myself I could never do that again. So when I made the decision that I would not, as much as I wished I hadn't survived and at the time, as much as I, you know, wanted to get out of there so I could do it again.
Yeah.
I had made a commitment to my brother, who is the closest to me in my family, that I wouldn't do that again. So I knew I had to make a go of it, and I knew I had to try. And I went to rehab, and I was inpatient rehab for 28 days. I went through withdrawals. Apparently, opiate withdrawals could be as bad, if not worse, than heroin withdrawals, is what they told me. I can't even begin to describe the pain that I went through and the weird stuff my body did, like the burning sensation on my skin, and just it was horrifying. But this was a really good program. And about 2 weeks into it, the cloud started to lift, and I started to actually pay attention and understand and learn and accept that I did have an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated, and I went to outpatient for another 6 months. And it's been 1 year and 11 months since I last used.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And in that time, I fought to get my job back. I jumped through all their hoops. I went through their fit-for-duty tests. I passed them. First time through, I called continually asking to be, you know, brought back to work. And they were saying, we don't have a place for you yet, or we don't know what to do with you. And they just kept putting me off. And so I was home for months and months and months without pay, trying to get my job back. And it got to the point where I thought, well, I'm going to have to maybe take this to the next level. And I called our guild president and asked him, you know, on what grounds, you know, should I still have my job if I pass the fit for duty test, if my doctor's cleared me, if I'm sober, you know, what is it that's preventing me from coming back to work? And it happened to be, coincidentally enough, that the next Monday when they called me and said, well, we have a little, like, desk job. We can stick you in for a little while. And so I went back to work, and I sat in their little corner and knew that it was just a place to stick me because they didn't know what else to do with me. So I started to work hard, and I started getting into different projects that were going on and taking hold of them and running with them. And a year and a half later, I've accomplished a lot. I've done quite a few things for the department, and I've worked really hard. And even though I will be going back to patrol in the next couple weeks, I feel like I have made enormous progress. And I'm back, and I'm strong, and I'm respected, and I believe I'm a better police officer today than I ever have been because of what I've learned, from what I know, what I understand, and how to deal with the depression, how to deal with the addiction, which is a disease, and I now realize that, and it, I feel like at 42 years old, I feel like I'm starting over. I'm starting over in a new life, and I guess the world is my limit. So we'll see what the future has to hold from here.
Well, I wanna commend you for being willing to share your story, because you've gotten to the brink that many officers have considered. Obviously, we know by the statistics that many officers go beyond that and actually take their own lives. And you've been given an opportunity, a gift, so to speak, to maybe share some perspective from that edge. And I'm wondering if you can maybe elaborate a little bit on, you know, just what you've learned about overcoming addiction, because I think it also needs to be said, just as much as cops need to talk about suicide, we really need to talk about addiction, because there are many, many, many cops with alcohol addictions and problems, and maybe a lesser number of cops that have addictions to all kinds of things that include prescription painkillers, just like you did, and they don't see it. I think you hit the nail on the head. They don't recognize that they have a problem, because these aren't illegal drugs. They came from a doctor.
Right. And so, and especially with alcohol, I mean, that's such a common place in police world. You know, it's what we do. It's a legal substance. You know, we're allowed to do that.
Well, it's our form of medication. It's legal, but we tend to abuse it. And, you know, cops need to come to grips with the fact that this job is daunting. Some days are absolutely horrific, but it's not just the horrific days. It's a combination of all kinds of little other days that build up cumulatively, and the stress of this job and the situations we get into and the people we see and the tragedies we have to endure, it compounds. And a lot of people turn to sort of a self-medication with alcohol or other things. And you're not the only kind of, you're not the only one that suffers from depression, because statistics show that many police officers also suffer from depression because, hey, face it, it's a depressing job in a depressing world, and we need to find more healthy means of combating that, of actually managing that stress and finding a way to recover from it as we endure the job so that we're still effective.
Right, and in our line of work, all we see is the bad. We see the ugliness of the world, and if you don't have a good balance in your life with healthy relationships and people at home, and at least in my case, when I isolated so badly that I didn't have any positive thing in my life, I didn't see any beauty in the world. I only saw the ugliness, and with cops, I mean, we always, and, you know, from the very beginning, have always gone out after shift, and it's sort of like to blow off steam, to relax. But you've also got the camaraderie. I mean, you guys are a tight-knit family, and a lot of cops only associate with other cops because, right. You know, we're, nobody else can understand us, basically. And so you get all those people together, and alcohol is the main focus. Off duty, you know, it's like the main thing that we do to hang out and let off steam.
Yeah. And, well, the other thing I heard you say that it reminds me of so many officers is that concept of having to be perfect. And, you know, unfortunately in this job, the society expects us to be perfect. We have to solve every problem. And then we compound that by feeling like we have to do a perfect job, and that is an overwhelming burden to try to overcome.
Well, cops are generally type A personalities. I mean, you kind of have to be to be in this job, and you are held to a higher standard, and not just on duty, but off duty. And with me, I lived in the city, and I lived in the jurisdiction in which I worked, so I was on duty 24 hours a day. I mean, I had to conduct myself properly to go to the grocery store or go to the dry cleaners because everybody knew me.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of stress. There was really no time off, no time to decompress, no room for mistakes. It was a pretty heavy burden. And
I think you said it. You know, this job compounds that kind of stresses we already put on ourselves with all kinds of others, and it becomes unmanageable. I don't think it's you. I don't think you're unique, in that particular respect. I think every one of us gets that sense of overwhelm. Different people manage it differently, and there are many people that think if I just go get a really strong workout, I'm going to feel better, and that works sometimes too. But you can over abuse your body with fitness just like you can with everything else, and they're still not managing the underlying issue. I am kind of curious about what you've learned. You know, I've had some experience with a 12-step program that is provided by AA and others, and I personally believe that the 12 steps are something we ought to teach everybody in elementary school, because it's really about how to get a hold of and manage your life and get in touch with who you are. I'm kind of curious what you've learned since then in ways to manage your addiction and maybe manage some stress in your life.
Well, I have been part of AA, and I have gone through the 12-step program. Fortunately for me, I found a program called Safe Call Now, which was formed about the same time as I had gone through my incident. And they found me in rehab, and it's specifically for law enforcement. And who else do they do? They do
first responders, I think.
First responders, firefighters, yeah.
Right.
And it's basically AA and support for them, both for marital problems, financial problems, alcoholism, even suicide.
Yeah.
And I attend. They have weekly AA meetings for police officers only, which I have found it's really the only AA meetings I can go to and feel comfortable in. When you go to, you know, the average AA meeting, you still feel like you're kind of an outsider. I mean, you can't tell them what you do. You can't tell them, you know, how you came to be where you are. And it, at least and feel comfortable. I mean, in my case, I've arrested half the people in the room.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, it just didn't work for me. And as soon as I found Safe Call Now, it's been amazing. It's been amazing. It's me with other people who not only do what I do, but have been in the same position that I've been in and, you know, have had the addiction, have had the alcoholism, have attempted the suicide. And it's an amazing group to be able to feel like you're not alone and to reach out and ask for help. And that was my biggest downfall, is I never asked for help. I was too proud. I was a police officer. You know, yeah. I can't show weakness.
Right.
Especially being a female. I mean, on top of everything else, for me to admit to them that I'm weak and I'm damaged and I can't do my job, it just wasn't an option. And if I had known of or reached out to find a place like Safe Call Now before this happened, I think we would have had a totally different outcome.
Yeah.
So I thank them a lot. And I'm now part of working with them as far as telling my story and doing different projects and some service with them.
Well, I was going to mention at the beginning that we actually met at Safe Call Now's first conference, and I had heard your story and really wanted you to come to Cops Alive and tell it, and I appreciate you being here. And I think now is a good time to do a plug. If anybody's listening and can identify with what Kathleen is saying and need to reach out, there are a number of national hotlines, but the one that is specifically by first responders, mostly cops, and for those same people is Safe Call Now. And their phone number is area code 206-459-3020. That's 206-459-3020. And they are staffed by people who have done your job or similar jobs and understand and can get you the kind of resources that you need to get you the help you need before you consider something like Kathleen did and consider that you have no other options. And there are other options. And I'm wondering, Kathleen, now, you know, you talked about keeping everybody at arm's length. What would people have seen? I mean, it sounds like when you described them, you certainly gave off all the warning signs, you know, giving away your earthly property and, you know, getting your affairs in order. And you did a lot of, and, you know, a big change in behavior. And you did a lot of things that are warning signs. And yet, as you said, you kept people at a distance and nobody actually tried to stop you. Have you, as your department, had some discussions about that? How do you feel about that?
Not my department, but I have had with Safe Call.
Yeah.
And definitely with the I'll say that during my ordeal, the department never came to my rescue and still haven't. But who did was all of my fellow cops.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot believe how much support and backup that I got from the officers that I've worked with over the years. And
well, it's about, you know, cops taking care of other cops. That's what Cops Alive is about. I mean, I think if we don't start taking care of ourselves as a profession, you know, we don't want the public to come in and do it. And you've described, I think, accurately that leadership in law enforcement organizations really don't know what to do with things like this. They're so uncomfortable that they're afraid to kind of embrace it. And yet the police officers that every organization has are their most valuable assets, their most valuable resources. It takes so long and so much money to select and hire and train a really good cop. And then they don't get, you know, their feet under them until they've been out on the street for a while. And you can't just keep replacing everybody with brand new rookies. That isn't the way a police department functions. So you have to take care of the assets you have, and you have to support people. And every cop is going to suffer the effects of stress, and every cop needs some sort of support. And so I was asking you, you know, what kind of warning signs should people have seen with you, and what could they have done to maybe turn things around? Maybe in your case, nothing, but I'm betting that, as you said, if you've gotten to an organization like Safe Call Now, they might have been able to turn you around.
Right. And as, like I said, as cops, we're very, very good manipulators, and we're good at covering up what's really going on. Although my signs were glaring, and I can't believe that they weren't obvious, and maybe they were, and nobody knew what to do or right. thought that I had it under control because I was a cop or I don't know what. But now, after what I've gone through and been back at work, I feel like I can almost pick those people out. Like, I can see it so clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that person is having a problem and they need help.
Yeah.
And, you know, why people weren't able to do that with me, I don't know. But I feel now it's up to me to use that experience and reach out to those people and make sure that they know that they do have a place like Safe Call to go to before they get to this point.
Yeah.
So I feel in a way, I feel enlightened a bit on the subject.
Well, you and I haven't talked about this, but one of the concepts that we talk about in our training programs is the concept we call True Blue Valor, which every cop prepares themselves mentally for dealing with an armed subject and being in combat. And every cop, I think, believes that that is the toughest thing that they're ever going to face. And the concept of True Blue Valor really talks about taking care of each other and being able to say to somebody, hey, you are really slipping. It looks like you're drinking too much. Maybe you're taking too many pain pills. You know, I'm concerned about you. What are you doing to get help? And I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts about that concept, because I think it's the toughest thing a police officer can do is to challenge one of their peers about their effectiveness and about their well-being. That's the real bottom line here. And I think one of the reasons most people don't do it is because they don't have any way to get any support or channel them into some help. And so agencies have to build that mechanism so that when you do challenge somebody, you're not going to get them fired. You're going to get them the help they need.
Right, right.
What do you think about that concept of it being the toughest thing that a cop can do?
Well, that's always the fear. And in my case, that was the fear, is that if I were to show that I had a problem or that I had a weakness or that I couldn't do my job, that I would just be fired, you know, that it would just be over.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about losing a job. It was about losing my identity.
Yep.
And I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. For me, I didn't seem to have an out. The only out for me was death. And having... If departments are, and our department is getting better, it's working directly with Safe Call Now, and it's helping set up a lot of things for officers. I still think we're light years away from what we need, but it's the officers themselves, like me and like others that have gone through it, that it's sort of our responsibility to go out and help those officers.
Yeah.
To see them before it's too late. To, like you say, not just say, hey, you got a problem, but to say, hey, you got a problem, here's what's available to you, here's what I can do to help you, and here's proof that it works. Because we're hard-headed. We're very, very hard-headed, and I think it takes an awful lot to admit, have somebody admit that they have a problem and that they need help.
Yeah, I think a lot of times the personality profile that makes a great cop also is what's going to cause their destruction, because they are so independent, they are so self-sufficient, and yet that's a myth. It isn't. It can't be. You have to have a support network. Law enforcement, even though we treat it like an individual sport, it is truly a team sport, and we have to be backing up one another, and that means both on the job and sort of off the job in, you know, taking care of our well-being.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm curious, after living through what you have, what bit of information, what would you share with other people out there so that they don't have to go down the same road that you went? What What, I don't know, revelation have you gleaned from this experience?
I think the biggest thing I can think of is asking for help. Don't assume, you know, that you're invincible and that you can do it yourself. Don't assume that, yeah, maybe you drink too much or whatever, you'll just cut down on your drinking, or you just won't drink on these certain days. Or, I mean, that doesn't work. If you're an alcoholic, that doesn't work. You cannot do it by yourself. It is beyond your control.
Yeah.
You need to reach out, and you need to swallow your pride, because in the long run, it's going to kill you one way or the other.
Yeah, I think the swallow your pride thing is the real tough part of it is, you know, we are so proud, and that makes us stronger. We kind of confuse that with courage.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's the reason we use that concept of true blue valor, is it really takes more courage to do those things that we think, you know, we're afraid to do, honestly. And part of it is pride, and part of it is a fear of losing the job. And you have proven, and actually you're the second officer I've met that has survived a suicide and been able to maintain their job. And, you know, I think a lot of times people's fears are worse than the reality. I know there are plenty of people out there listening who have suffered from PTSD and other issues and don't feel like their agencies have supported them. And I am the first to say our agencies around the world need to get better at recognizing how we can manage our human resources so that they stay strong throughout an entire career and retire, as I call it, to ollie ollie oxen free and be able to live happily ever after. I think that's the goal in law enforcement, and yet most of us, you know, we're young, we don't care, we're not planning on retiring, it's, you know, we just don't think about it.
Mm-mm.
And agencies have a responsibility to actually take some leadership there and pave the way. And my advice is you better be paving the way now before you actually have a problem with your agency. I see a lot of agencies that have great programs, but it's because somebody committed suicide there and they've learned the hard way. And so
exactly.
If you're listening and your agency hasn't been through that, now's a good time to plant some seeds, to build a peer support organization, to build a family support organization, to have the medical and psychological support networks there that these officers can utilize to keep them functioning and working and not lose them and not lose, you know, in your case, all those years of experience.
Right. Right. And solely because I've survived this, I've been on the department 14 years and I've had as much training as I have and been in different specialty units. I feel like I am a huge asset to the department. I have a lot to offer them. And, there's others out there like that also that are being wasted because they're not getting the help that they need.
Yeah, I've certainly been in a lot of departments whose attitude about anything is don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. We can always replace you.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that is just foolish because it is costly in so many ways to try to fill every void with a brand new recruit. You know, we need to capitalize on the experience and the expertise we have within our organizations and not just throw them away.
Right. The more experience an officer has, the more that they have to offer the department and the city.
Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts that you want to share about, you know, what you would recommend either to officers or their agencies about dealing with this issue? Or there's a whole bunch of issues here, actually.
Well, it needs to stop being such a taboo. I mean, it is what it is, and it happens, and it's out there. And people need to talk about it. And departments need to get involved. They need to understand that, you know, not only do cops burn out. I mean, we all reach burnout at some point. But there's some serious issues. I mean, we have a huge divorce rate. We have we have a high suicide rate. We have a high alcoholism rate. I mean, there's reasons for that. And that kind of thing needs to be paid attention to. That kind of thing needs to be addressed before it gets too far. And then, of course, for the officer themselves, it's realizing they can't do everything by themselves, and they do need help.
Yeah. Well, agencies spend a lot of money worried about the liability issues of driving and shooting and legal issues. And in my opinion, wellness is a liability issue, and it is an issue we need to be dealing with, and we need to have mechanisms in place to train and support officers to care for themselves, just like we have in place for them to care for their weapons, to care for their vehicles. You know, we've got to start taking care of ourselves and each other, and it really needs to be an agency mandate.
Absolutely.
Kathleen, I can't tell you how appreciative I am of you not only taking your time to talk with us, but, you know, being so open and honest to share with us what you've been through. I want to tell you, you're not alone. I went through a lot of the same things that you went through, and I think everybody listening can identify with all or parts of your story. And to all the people out there listening, I hope Kathleen's story tells you that, you know, you can survive this. There are other options and opportunities for you, and suicide is not the solution. But it is an issue that you have to take responsibility for, because I agree with you, Kathleen. We are very good at hiding, and we're very good at lying, and we're very good at, you know, always being strong for everybody around us and then not doing anything to take care of ourselves.
Exactly.
So I'm hoping that your time today opens some doors, facilitates some discussion, and gets people to talk. I love what you just said. It is what it is. Let's put it out there. Let's talk about it. And maybe let's put some mechanisms in place so our agency doesn't have to suffer the loss. Because, by the way, for those of you listening that have never experienced it, frequently losing an officer to suicide is more devastating to the agency than losing an officer in the line of duty. We're expecting the line of duty loss. We have all kinds of mechanisms in place for that. I'm not trying to diminish it. I'm just pointing out that when something happens like a suicide, it is generally unexpected, and there is an awful lot of guilt that goes along with it, and it can be more devastating. So this discussion is a good place to start to put in the mechanisms to actually do something about it. And Kathleen, we couldn't have done that without you. And I heard you say you're not exactly sure what the grand plan in the universe is for you. But I have to tell you, thanks from everybody listening, because at least you brought this discussion to our lips, that we're able to talk about it, and that you're able to talk about it after having lived through it. And I commend you for that.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity to get my story out. And there is a reason I survived. I mean, I have to believe that. And if it means that I'm able to help even one person, then that's why. That's worth it.
Thanks. I want to give the Safe Call Now phone number again for those of you that are listening. Safe Call Now is an organization in Seattle, but they take calls from around the country. And actually, their confidentiality laws, which are some of the strongest in the United States, affect your call. So even if you're calling from out of state, out of Washington State, you are protected under their very strict confidentiality laws. And you can reach Safe Call Now by dialing area code 206-459-3020, 206-459-3020. And there are people on the other end of that line that have done the job you've done and are willing and able to help you. So if you're thinking about suicide, or if you have an addiction problem or an alcohol problem, call them. They can help you. I also want to point out that if you're listening to this interview, you're probably on the Cops Alive website, and attached to this particular article is going to be a link to one of our roll call trainings. We provide roll call training guides for agencies to use. They only take 10 to 15 minutes, so you can squeeze it into any roll call. And we have one specifically on the issue of starting a discussion around the topic of police suicide. So if you're on our website, in this article, there'll be a link there where you can click and download that guide, and it gives you some discussion questions and a form to use to actually go to roll call and talk about it today. So I want to thank everybody listening, and Kathleen, I want to thank you very much for your time and your courage, and I appreciate you bringing this message to us. And I look forward to talking with you again And I just say from the bottom of my heart, thank you for sharing your story with us.
No, thank you.
You have been listening to Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. This is John Marks, and I encourage you to check out our blog site at www.copsalive.com and start that discussion today in your agency about suicide and some of the other issues that go with it, like alcoholism, depression, and addiction. This is John Marks signing off. Have a great day and stay safe.